four girls with stories to tell and secrets to keep. "Hello," a woman said from behind the desk. "Good morning." My father reached into his jacket pocket, from which he produced an envelope that contained an application for my enrollment. He handed it to her. "This is an application for my daughter." She took the envelope. "She's 6.5 hours old," he said. "Congratulations," she said, seemingly unsurprised. "This is what we were told to do because of the waiting list." "We appreciate your interest," she said and smiled enigmatically. 4 years later, on an otherwise unremarkable mid-August morning in 1972, my mother stood on the cracked pavement of the driveway of the pale pink stucco two-story house in which we lived near the bottom of a steep single-block street in a lower tier of the North Berkeley Hills. The letter from the Child Study Center had arrived in the mail that spring. In the foyer, the envelope in hand, she had sent up a silent prayer to a God in which she no longer believed, but to which she reached out to from time to time when she felt desperate enough, that I had been chosen. She tore it open. "We are delighted to accept Susanna for admission this fall," the letter read. In the empty house, my mother shrieked with delight and then clamped her hand over her mouth to stifle her glee, even though no one could have heard her. Welcome, friends. My name is Patricia, or most people call me Patches, and I'm the host of the Morbidly Curious Book Club, a nonfiction-only book club diving into the darker macabre parts of your library. And today I start with a question. What if your parents turned you into a human lab rat when you were a child? Will that change the story of your life? Will that change who you are? Our April book is Susanna Breslin's Data Baby, My Life in a Psychological Experiment. When Susanna Breslin is a toddler, her parents enroll her in an exclusive laboratory preschool at the University of California, Berkeley, where she becomes one of over 100 children who are research subjects in an unprecedented 30-year study of personality development that predicts who she and her cohort will grow up to be. Decades later, trapped in what she feels like is an abusive marriage and battling breast cancer, she starts to wonder how growing up under a microscope shaped her identity and life choices. Already a successful journalist, she makes her own curious history the subject of her next investigation. From experiment rooms with one-way mirrors, to children's puzzles with no solutions, to condemned basement laboratories, her life-changing journey uncovers the long-buried secrets hidden behind the renowned study. The question at the gnarled heart of her quest: did the study know her better than she knew herself? At once bravely honest and sharply witty, Data Baby is a compelling and provocative account of a woman's quest to find her true self and an unblinking exploration of why we turn out as we do. Few people in all of history have been studied from such a young age and for as long as this author, but the message of her book is universal. In an era when so many of us are looking to technology to tell us who to be, it's up to us to discover who we actually are. Now let me tell you about Susanna Breslin and how excited I am to sit down and chat with her today. So she's a freelance journalist and a Forbes.com senior contributor. You should go check out some of her articles. They are absolutely fascinating. From 2018 to 2019, she was the Lawrence Graham Jr. Postgraduate Fellow at UC Berkeley's Investigative Reporting Program. Her reporting and essays have appeared in The Atlantic, Slate, Harper Bazaar, The Daily Beast, Salon, Newsweek, The Guardian, and Variety, among other media outlets. She holds a BA in English from UC Berkeley and an MA from the Program for Writers at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and she currently lives in Los Angeles. Was it a choice that you made to not do the audiobook, or did they choose kind of somebody else? Did you not want to be a part of that at all? Or
so it was my choice to not do the audiobook. I was given the opportunity to audition for it. So I think, at least in my experience, the publisher wants the best person for the project. When they sent me an email saying, "Would you like someone else to read it or would you like to audition for it?" I was like, "You're going to make me audition to read my own story?" Then I thought, wait, I had been stressing about it. And I also had migraines while I was working on the book, and the story is kind of hard for me to relive. And so I thought, wait, having somebody else read it would be awesome. I went and listened to a bunch of different people who were popular, who did audiobooks, and found somebody I thought would be a good fit. And so I recommended her to the publisher. They hired her, and it worked out great. It was kind of a weird choice. I mean, I think about it, maybe a part of me is like, I should have read it myself. One thing I've tried to do with this book experience is like learn as much as I can and also be experience focused rather than like results focused. So I try to approach a reading or an interview with like, what can I learn from this, or how will this experience inform this whole process? So I did kind of rob myself of the experience of finding out what it would be like to read my book out loud into a microphone for 3 days, but maybe I don't really want to know what that experience would have been like.
Right. That might be a lot to handle, but it might be really rewarding. You know, I thought the audiobook narrator was great. It was a really interesting experience. And I love the cover too. It's very eerie in a way. Got this picture of you as a baby that's got this like digitized, almost old TV type of glare on it. And it's, I remember seeing this advertised months prior and immediately I was like, this is on my list. I have to buy this. Also, my life in a psychological experiment. Please tell me everything about what this is.
Editing Patches here. I do need to give a little bit of a disclaimer. I was talking about purchasing this book, but I need to mention that Legacy Lit graciously sent me a copy of Data Baby, I think at the beginning of 2024. However, they did not ask me to give a review, make it a book club pick, speak positively of it, none of that. They did not ask me to do anything. They just graciously sent it to me. I am on the Hachette and Legacy Lit PR listing, so they just send me books from time to time, and I'm forever grateful. But I just need to throw that out there. So shout out to Legacy Lit. Okay, that's it for now. I'll be back later.
What was the process like for, did you have this cover design in mind, or was there like a team that kind of like gave you options, or?
So with that, we're just as a first note, that's not me on the cover. That's some
really?
Image. Yeah, it's an image they licensed from one of those image providers. So it's not me, but So the way that it worked was the publisher sent me 3 mock-ups to look at, and they were all, but I had already contributed some suggestions and sent them some other book covers that I liked. And so they gave me like, they send you an image that has like the 3 of them together. There was this one that ended up being the cover. There was another one that was like very sort of, it was like a woman's face kind of digitized with a white background. More like, I don't know. I was going to say it looked very millennial to me.
I know exactly what you're talking about though.
The third one, I can't actually remember what it was. So I guess it was definitely like sort of weirder and harder, but I liked the image of this little girl was sort of at the core of the story, right? That was the issue with the one that I'm sort of referring to as millennial. It was like a girl who was like in her late 20s or early 30s or something like that. And the core of the story is really about a little girl and her experiences and then how those things in a way shape the rest of her life. And so I liked that it captured the little girl that I was who started out in the experiment itself, but it's got that sort of creepy, sort of digitized, like you said, old TV image sort of layered over it. So I love the cover. It's probably one of my favorite things about the book. Yeah. So I think when I signed the contract, I had, author approval on the cover. So I said that one that ended up being the cover was my favorite. And then everyone agreed. And so we were off to the races at that point. So it was like good. Collaborative, but it just ended up also being the thing that I liked the best, but I definitely had input, and I would definitely encourage any authors who don't to have like cover approval in your contract, because that's so important on so many levels.
And probably overlooked completely, not even really getting a say in the final product.
Well, it's so hard. Publishing is such a walled garden, and like you can get these things, but I think publishers make authors feel like, or prospective authors feel like they can't even ask. You know what I mean? And I wish, I wish that authors felt more entitled to call the shots in terms of what their book looks like from the outside to the inside, and less like they had to do whatever a publisher says because there's only this finite amount of them and they're the boss.
Right. So obviously writing to you is not new. This has been something you have always done, something you've always been interested in doing. This feels like the first piece of you, though, that all of like this just felt like you put so much into this, right? This is your life story. What has been the experience having something like this that details as much as you can out into the book, out on the shelves?
Is that your indirect way of asking me why my Goodreads score is so shitty?
No, but I do want to ask. I'm actually, part of my review was like, why are the reviews so low for this? But more so, I'm just curious as to like, you've been writing a lot. Sure. And you've obviously put yourself in those pieces as well. But this just feels like all of you type of, yeah. You know, this is your memoir, right? So I'm just curious as to what that feels like, putting something so vulnerable, I guess, out there and having people like weird, morbid people read it for the month of April.
Yeah, I wasn't drawn to writing this book in a way. First of all, I like grew up in the study and it was just always a part of my life, and being studied in my head was not a big deal. And I frankly could never, I knew other people thought it was weird, but to me, it just seemed ordinary. So it took a long time for me to sort of be convinced that this was an interesting story. I've always been a writer. It was what the one thing I was good at. My parents were English professors and my father also wrote several books. So as a writer, I wrote fiction and nonfiction, and I was a journalist, but in the writing that I did, I was often writing about somebody else. I did write personal essays, but I don't know that I ever envisioned writing a memoir. I was always interested in other things more than I was myself. And so people kept saying, oh, you should write about this story and the study. And it just happened over a long period of time. I have a conflicted relationship to memoirs. I think they're kind of like emotion porn. They're often written by women, for women. So it's this sort of what might be called like a pink ghetto in literature. And I, as a journalist, certainly don't see myself as somebody who's like sitting around and writing about their feelings, which I have some level of disdain for. But that is the command of a memoir. It's like, what is your story and how did you feel and how did the ways you feel change over time? And that was really, really hard for me. I tend to like intellectualize things rather than sit around and process my feelings around them as much. So it was a difficult journey, but it just kind of happened. And then I got a book contract and I was like, oh shit, well now I got to actually write the thing. So here we are. But putting it out in the world was difficult because I don't particularly like the way that I come across in parts of the book as a fuck up, as somebody who makes mistakes, as somebody who is anxious or sad or was like an ignored little kid. Those things are embarrassing to me. I would rather be perceived as like tough. Or somebody once described my journalism as unblinking and unflinching. It's like, yeah, I want to be like this 6'1". I want to be perceived as like this Amazonian warrior woman, not like a little girl who nobody paid attention to. So she turned to a psychological experiment for a sense of self. I'm like, so it's been challenging.
Well, you know, this will probably sound fake, but I promise it's not. There's been a couple of girls that I've spoken to in the Discord chat that have read this book and loved it just as much as I did. And I can guarantee you that is not the takeaway that we had at all. We did see you as this Amazonian warrior and thought you were so badass. So I would like to address that first and foremost. And you also mentioned, you've mentioned this in the book itself, but also in interviews, that you were kind of pushed away from the idea of making this kind of journalistic and not necessarily this piece on the experiments, the blocks, your life through it, but more so towards the memoir side. And that seems to resonate with reviewers, where they are like, this was marketed incorrectly, this should have been more about this, but also it's not really how it works. You know, you're talking about how publishing is already this, you know, well-oiled machine, and there's not much that we can do to change kind of what people want. So I was fascinated that you did put that in the book, where you were like, no, you know, this happened, but I kind of wanted it to be more of this instead of this.
So, you know, I had an idea for the book, which I turned into a book proposal, which was then shopped around to these different publishing houses to see if they wanted to publish it. So the book was not written, it was pitched, although part of it was written as part of the proposal. The way I pitched it was reflective of how I write, which was, it was interweaving narrative nonfiction, journalism, and memoir / personal essay. So it was this hybrid thing, and we're certainly at a, you know, development level with memoirs where, like, people are writing memoirs that don't fit into conventional slots. This, you know, we're beyond Eat, Pray, Love at this point, I would like to think. I don't know that the publishing business is in the business of putting out what they perceive to be great writing. They're in the business of putting out products that will sell beginning and end. So a lot of what happens to a book as it moves through this factory that's churning out book-shaped products is that the book becomes very affected by that factory. So, for example, where is this going to sit in a Barnes & Noble, which is the only big book chain, brick and mortar book chain left? Where it's going to sit on the shelf becomes extremely important. And we don't want it on the shelf that says hybrid memoir, because that shelf doesn't exist. So it was agreed upon that I would write it as a memoir. And I felt like, well, I can do that. I've read Eat, Pray, Love. I've read Cheryl Strayed's Wild. What are the other, like, classics of memoirs?
I actually really don't read memoirs.
Well,
rarely.
Don't start. And so,
it's true. The last one I read was Jeanette McCurdy's, because it was titled "I'm Glad My Mom Died." I was like, "Oh my god, I have to figure out what's going on here," because I never really watched iCarly. But anyway, continue.
So I think it just became so. I agreed to write it as a memoir. I think I thought, well, you know, I can do that. But I think during the process of writing the book, you know, it wasn't just a memoir. I was also functioning as a journalist, and so it became this other things. And the book was more complicated in execution, and that was difficult to do in a side of a corporate machine that doesn't allow for creativity, experimentalism, and inventiveness a lot of the time, because its interests are making profits, and that's it. Mm-hmm. So I did my sort of best that I could to have a foot in each world. I don't know that I mastered it. I certainly tried. I think that when people say this book didn't meet my expectations, that's like totally fair. You know, I think people come to memoirs with certain expectations, which is they're going to have like this emotional connection to the central character, and they're going to go along with her on her journey, and they're probably going to have some type of moment at the end where she learns to love someone else or love herself or transcends the person that she used to be. And I think those memoirs are fairy tales. And I'm not sure what they have to do with reality or any real woman's lived experience. And I didn't want to add another bullshit fairy tale to the pile. Life is more complicated than that. And it certainly doesn't exist in three acts.
I personally, when I was reading it, thought the structure of it did make sense to me, because your whole thing, the whole spiel of the experiment itself was, is it predictable to determine or predetermine or kind of see how a person's life is going to unravel and what that's going to look like, because obviously nobody lives the same life. Are we able to see early signs of stuff? Are we able to see how people react? You know, the M&M's scene, like, what is that going to tell us? Like, her actually grabbing the M&M's and when we aren't looking, you know, is that going to predetermine something for us? So for you to start the book off and say, this is kind of like what the experiment was, and then here's how my life went. Mm-hmm. I think that made complete sense for me. And, you know, it's something interesting, too, to get into the book. You start off with saying, as I understood it, my life in a psychological experiment began on the day I was born. This felt very meticulous, right? And then later in the book, I think it was page like 180-something, you actually hear kind of a different story, because at first you heard you were 6 hours old, and then you were actually like a month and a half old, and it was actually Mom's idea, which was a plot twist for me. I didn't see that coming. Do you think you ever got the full story on how exactly you got in the experiment itself?
No, I don't know that I'll ever understand the truth of how I ended up in the study. Growing up, I thought that my father had left my mother and I in the hospital room with this application to this preschool in hand and delivered it there in hopes that I would end up on their years-long waiting list and then when I was preschool age would become a student at this, you know, elite exclusive preschool that was associated with the university where my father taught. I don't know why I would think that if I wasn't told that. My vague sense is that my mother told that story, and that the reason it stuck with me is it has sort of two pieces to it. One is like this idea of, oh, like my father thought I was special. He's like doing this thing that will ensure I'll be on this like special track in hopes, you know, I'll become someone great. At the same time, it's also a story about my father abandoning my mother and me as well in the hospital room, even if it's just for a day, which is a narrative my mother would have very much liked to tell. So it resonates for a few reasons that as I believe she did tell me that story. But, you know, that's when I am in my late 20s, my father dies. And at that point, I'm not really asking, you know, I haven't asked him, hey, Dad, you know, was it your idea? I had no reason to doubt it at that time. Was it your idea to put me in this study? And it isn't until much later, I go back to Berkeley and interview my mother and say to her, you know, did Dad put me in the study? That was my impression. And she says, absolutely not. You know, it was me. I was the one. It was my idea. It was unclear in that moment if that was true. Did I doubt? Was my memory wrong? Or was she trying to center herself as the star of a story I was trying to tell, which is what she had spent a lot of her life doing in the context of me, is sort of making herself the center of everything. Was she trying to hijack my story in some way or reclaim it as hers, right? She's the hero of that tale. And so now my mother died. And so I guess I'll never totally know for sure.
Mm-hmm. And there was something too interesting in this book you specified, because I feel like I have the verbiage wrong myself. You specified there's a difference between a project and a study. Can you go into that a little bit and what exactly is the difference? Is one of them more a little bit more nefarious than the other, or?
Certainly what I seem to be implying. The official name of the study that I was in was Block and Block Longitudinal Study 1969 to 1999. Colloquially, it's known as the Block Study because it was started by Jack and Jean Block. They were its principal investigators at UC Berkeley, where the study was conducted. The kids in the study and families were told it was called the Block Project. And so as I was writing the story, it was sort of like, why is it, if everyone calls it the Block Study, why are they telling us from early childhood that it's called the Block Project? It seems logical to me that it would sound less sort of menacing. It was a way to communicate with us kids, like we're part of this collective project. We're all doing it together. But the reality is, it's a study. You are a kind of guinea pig. So I think calling it a project was a way to make it seem sort of less creepy than it really was, and sort of points to the ways in which the relationship between the person who studies and the person who is studied is fraught and complicated, because everyone's always managing this unspoken power dynamic between themselves.
Editing Patches here. It was around this time that they started some construction outside. So you're going to hear some humming or my Google alerts going off. You're probably going to hear some humming. You might have heard it already. They are paving outside, which of course creates the loudest noise it could possibly create. So I apologize for that. And now let's get back to the show.
There was an interesting sense of parenthood in this experiment, right? Where you were finally getting this attention that you were craving, but that's also rude to say because you were a child. Of course you were wanting some sort of attention that you didn't feel like you were getting at home. What was the sense of parenthood like within this program?
So when I was around 4, I started going to the preschool where they were collecting kids who would be in this study. They gathered the cohort for the study over 3 consecutive classes of preschoolers. And the preschool had been designed for spying on children. It has 2 buildings. One building is T-shaped, and it has these mirror-shaped classrooms that have a hidden observation gallery in the middle where you can go in as a researcher and spy on the kids in the classroom. And there's a mesh screen, and also there's like a plastic film, so they can't see you, but you can see them. So when I was at the preschool, I had no idea that that observation gallery existed, that anyone was back there, that I was in a study. Periodically, I and other kids who were in the study would be pulled out of the classroom, which I do remember, and we would be walked over to the administrative building, which is like across this concrete walkway, into these game, what they called a game room. And we would play games with somebody who was, you know, doing the research. And I didn't know that at the time, but those were, you know, ways in which we were being assessed. And in fact, those rooms have one-way mirrors, and they also have these, you know, eavesdropping devices where somebody can go outside the room, watch through the one-way mirror, or, you know, see what we're doing, set up an experiment, and see what happens when they leave us alone. And so during that period, I had no idea. I've compared the process of knowing I was being studied to being adopted, when sometimes people say, like, oh, I always knew I was adopted. They don't remember, like, some big conversation. It was just kind of always there. I remember when I was around 6, there was a woman came to our house, and she followed me around, and she watched me play in my room, and she had my mother and I play some games at the kitchen table while she watched. I think at that point I kind of understood there was a group of people who were interested in me, and how probably was told, like, you know, they were interested in how kids grow up or who you are or something like that. And it's not really until I'm around 7. At that point, we would go to Tolman Hall, which was where the psychology department was on the UC Berkeley campus, and we would be assessed in these experiment rooms. And I think at that point, I sort of started to understand there's something going on here. There were these one-way mirrors, and I sort of had this sense that somebody's on the other side watching this person talk to me about my life and who I am and who I think I might grow up to be. In the process of doing that, you know, I was kind of left alone a lot at home. And so my parents were busy. And I think at the study, when I was being studied, I got a lot of close attention that in my mind made me feel a little bit like these researchers are kind of like a third parent. There's this other group of people out there who are sort of watching over me. My parents were atheists, and so it, you know, I think there's a parallel to be made between that idea in my head and religion, which is there's something comforting about this idea of like, oh, well, there's this person who's following my life, even if you're just making it up in your head.
It's so fascinating that you say that, though, because I also, too, saw like a religious metaphor within all of this and this idea of an entity present, like watching you. So that's fascinating that you mentioned that. Was there any parts of the writing process that you had to leave out of this book while writing it? Any bits of history? Maybe you just didn't remember them clear enough, or maybe the publisher or the editors were just saying, we don't really need this. Is there anything that you could share with us, I guess, that didn't make it into the final product?
So I knew when I was writing the book that there would probably be stuff that I had to take out for legal reasons. That wasn't helpful to think about while I was writing the book itself. So I kind of decided I'll just put everything in the manuscript. And I knew because I had a book contract that the book would be legally vetted by an attorney hired by the publishing house down the line. And I'll just cross that bridge when it came to it. So there is a significant difference between the manuscript that I wrote and what was published because of that legal vetting process. And, you know, that the attorney who legally vets your book is working for the publisher, and they are not working for the author, and they're interested in protecting the interests of the publisher. So there's a way in, there were things that I would have loved to include that I just couldn't because they were potentially problematic. There were things that I did that you might think were sort of innocuous, but that I couldn't include. So that was another sort of complicating factor, but is the reality of sort of the business of making books.
Legally, too, while we're on the topic, I'm curious to know, this was a study up until the age of 32. What did, I guess, NDAs look like? Like, there was a part where you were taken out of class and you get back and your friend is like, what were you doing? And you didn't specify if you told your friend or not. Like, were you allowed to talk about this kind of thing? Or was it just part of your life that you kept to yourself?
Yeah, and that's a good question. Like, we didn't have to sign an NDA. I could tell anybody anything. I generally, though, have been secretive about what happened in the study. And I think, like, when I would go get assessed when I was a kid and I would go home and my parents would say, what happened? Would they ask you? I would not want to tell. And that was actually something I wrestled with in writing with the book. It kind of felt like some kind of betrayal to the study. And I started to wonder if the people in the study actually sort of perpetuated that in a way. Like, we're a part of this project. We're doing this thing together. We have these intimate moments where you tell me all the things in your life that maybe nobody else even knows. And it was, maybe it's like your relationship with your priest, if you had one, where like there's, it's this one intimate relationship that you don't share with anybody else. So I was certainly free to talk about it, but I, until I wrote the book, I actually did not spend much time telling anybody else about it. I think it felt private and like a special thing that I was in this group, and it was like a secret club, right? Like where you go, you don't tell everyone you're in Fight Club, right?
That's exactly what I was thinking of, Fight Club. Yeah, precisely.
Kids Fight
Club. It was like your own little thing. Yeah, absolutely. Was your sister a part of the program? I can't remember. I know you mentioned briefly that she did something, but I can't remember exactly.
My sister attended a summer session there, but as far as I know, she was not ever part of a study there.
So you briefly talk about this in the book a bit, and your opinions on the program itself. How correct do you think these programs and experiments were? Do you think they did a little bit more harm than good? We also had a book club member kind of ask this as well. Mm-hmm. Like, coming out at the end of this, do you think anything was accurate? Do you think this was worth it? A waste of time? Kind of, where are you at thinking about it now?
broadly speaking, and certainly psychology has a replication crisis going on where there are these studies that are conducted, they're taken as gospel. And then when another researcher comes along and conducts their own study or analyzes that study's data, it turns out that the results are something entirely different. Like, I was trying to Google something the other day of, does taking this certain supplement help joints? And there's like three different studies show three completely different things. And so it's hard to say how reliable the results of the research that they did on us are. Also, every researcher is coming with all these biases, the biases of their own thesis or theory, the bias of whoever's funding their research, and the biases of their interest in what somebody, another professor, called academic empire building. And, you know, these studies come out from somebody who's in the business of, you know, building a career, and they want things to go a certain way. Now, I think a lot of what they found out about us to be valuable, but it was a longitudinal study. It took place over a 30-year period, and a lot changed in the world and in the study over that time. It was originally started by a married couple, and the woman died halfway through. And I think that had a big effect on the success of the study. And by the time the study ended and had essentially proved that largely personality traits remain relatively stable over time from childhood and well into adulthood, the world was kind of already there. Personality traits are a given. Whereas when the study was started, it was unclear if personality traits shape human behavior or the situations in which we find ourselves shape human behavior. Now it's like people hire based on personality traits. So I think it contributed. Now there's a cost when you have human research subjects, right? I think the research would say, well, you know, we follow all these protocols and we take all these measures. And so when we study children, they don't know or they're not affected. But I was affected in ways that were positive. I think that gave me a sense of self and reassurance that I might not have had otherwise. But there are also what I've experienced to be negative effects, which is, you know, having somebody scrutinize every aspect of your life is not entirely conducive to a happy childhood or healthy adulthood, as Jeanette McCurdy also proves, right? That's another person who grows up with everyone paying attention to her, judging her, analyzing her behavior, and that induces a kind of stress that I think is hard to outgrow. I'm glad that I did it, but sometimes I wonder who I would have been had I not been in the study. Would I be a mentally healthier person, or was the study in my life kind of a saving grace that helped me, especially during times when I was very depressed?
Almost harmful or almost harsh on yourself because you're thinking maybe there was something that could have been changed or done differently because I was in this study. Something that is brought up a lot, I notice, in interviews with you is consent is always brought up. People are always asking, you know, like, well, how do you feel about this? Like, you didn't consent to doing this. Obviously, you were however old, 6 hours, a month old, however, whatever the truth is. But that seems to be a common denominator with some of the questions that you're asked. And I'm so curious to know your thoughts on the idea of giving consent to something like this when obviously you couldn't have.
Right. So when I was a kid, obviously my parents consented for me. There was a time when I was still a minor where when they would bring us in for our assessments, they would get consent from us. They also had to get consent from our parents because we were minors, but they were still making sure that we wanted to be involved. And, you know, some kids declined to continue to participate in the study. When I became an adult and started writing this book, I did think about this issue of consent more, especially because it's, you know, consent is a big issue in our culture right now. And, you know, what is the consent of a child? You know, child is also, you know, a child is often interested in pleasing the adults around it. So it's like, even if I had the opportunity to consent for myself, how appropriate would that consent have been? What I see it resonating with now is when I see these kids whose lives are being lived online by parents, like mommy bloggers or mommy influencers, who, you know, the child's life is commodified and sold on social media from the moment they have, you know, a sonogram picture to post. And like, there's a joke where they refer to a baby as another bundle of content. I don't know if you've heard that, you know, which is monetized. There is no consent. Often the child is not even aware. And then, you know, when the mother says, oh, well, she wants to do it, or he wants, you know, he likes doing this stuff, you can't take that at face value because the child depends upon the parent for survival. So why would they not consent? It'll be interesting to see when these kids grow up and start writing their own memoirs about what it was like to have the most intimate, complicated details of your life pushed out on social media, whether you're potty training or having a meltdown in a supermarket, and how are they gonna feel? I was studied, but at least it was all private. They're gonna have all these intimate details exposed, and everyone's like weighing in. That is distressing to me.
Absolutely, and that's the people with good intentions too, because they don't even realize how many predators there are on the internet and how horrifying that is.
Yeah.
I can't get on board with the mommy vlogging. It's so disturbing. You did mention, I guess, at one point in the book that there were people who left the program, but I guess it never crossed my mind that there could be a point where the person was old enough to realize, maybe I don't want to be a part of this anymore. So I didn't even realize that that was a possibility. I love how, too, speaking of projects and studies and experiments and all this, you also bring up Ted Kaczynski, which is a fascinating topic.
It is
a fascinating topic. I actually I read a book recently, Jamie Gehring's book, Madman in the Woods. She's the one who lived next to Ted Kaczynski, and Ted Kaczynski like held her and stuff, and it was a fascinating memoir as well. But I'm always so fascinated by Ted Kaczynski and the effects of, I guess, other experiments and how you intertwined that with this one.
I'm not super well versed on this study, and it's been a while since I looked at it, or I'm not, you know, biblical in my understanding of Ted's life, but I believe Ted started going to Harvard as an undergrad when he was 16, and he became one of maybe 20 young Harvard undergrads who were in a cohort being studied by Henry A. Murray, who was this famous psychologist at Harvard. And he subjected Ted and the other boys in this cohort to these extremely abusive experiments, where they were essentially terrorizing them and trying to get them to sort of break their moral ground. And, you know, obviously people are very interested in like how much that shaped Ted's life. And as am I, you know, I think it's like similar to me where all these forces have to combine. You know, Ted shows up in a certain way. He ends up in a study, and the study is abusive. It's like this constellation of things have to happen in this very individuated way to create this certain result. And he, you know, obviously becomes the Unabomber. At a certain point, Ted's data from that study becomes very of interest publicly when he's identified as the Unabomber. And years ago, a journalist was able to identify Ted's code name in the study, which was Lawful, ironically. And at that point, Ted's file was pulled from the archive where it was held at Harvard. Coincidentally, that archive at Harvard also holds some of the data from the study that I was in. So people have tried to understand, when Ted was alive, how the study shaped him. He would never talk about it. And I actually wrote him several letters while I was writing my book, asking him if what had happened in the study, if he would talk about his experiences, and he never responded and since died. But that's just sort of another question of, like, how much did being terrorized by scientists shape his life? And another thing I know is of interest to you is, like, sort of other examples of that in pop culture. So, like, Eleven on Stranger Things is, like, she's another kid. I think both her parents were in MK Ultra. Obviously, this is made up, you know, and they sort of gave her this telekinetic ability. What was the other one? Logan with Hugh Jackman, and then Laura is the little girl who shows up. She's another lab rat child. So I always love seeing these stories, especially like little girls who are sort of science experiments, and then they grow up and they have some sort of superpower that makes them both stronger and more dangerous than they would have been otherwise.
I'm glad you brought up Eleven first, because I didn't want to say that in case it was, like, upsetting at all, because immediately I was thinking of Eleven. I love Stranger Things, but, yeah, and I loved Logan, so, yeah, I was interested, too, exactly if there's anything else in pop, like, we mentioned Big Brother, we mentioned Truman Show and whatnot, and, of course, Stranger Things and Logan are fairly new. If there was any other time in pop culture, I guess, where you would see stuff like that and think, like, oh, that's interesting that, you know, something that's happened to me has become a fictionalized tale. Like, why didn't I come out of this with telekinetic powers?
I wish. The one other book / movie is The Girl with All the Gifts, where she's a little zombie, and I believe at that school they're conducting experiments on the kids. Anything where there's, like, a little girl being subjected to experiments is always resonates, because that sense is familiar.
And of course you don't have to answer this, I guess, either at all or truthfully, but what was just the strangest thing that they made you do, where even to this day you're like, what was the point of that? Like, what did
you know? I wish I had a story of, like, and then we all dropped acid, or then we were hooked up to a electrocution machine. So, sorry. The things that stand out to me are, well, there's a few. One is there was some thing that they did that I don't know, where they were testing our startle response when we were very young. And I always wonder, like, what is that? Like, was it just like a jack-in-the-box? Or how were you startling us? I don't know. That's a little weird. Another one was there's like a skin conductiveness test or something, which is essentially a test to figure out if you're lying. That's a little weird. Why are you hooking young people up to a lie detector test? The other one that actually sort of broke my heart a little was at a certain point I found these archival boxes at the preschool where they had studied us. And in those boxes, there were these protocols on how to test us. And one of them described them giving us a puzzle, and we were supposed to attempt to put together the puzzle. And the examiner was encouraging us. And the reality was that the puzzle was incomplete. Not all the pieces were there. And so we would get frustrated. It was part of test to see, like, how long did it take us to get frustrated attempting to solve a puzzle that could not be solved. And there was sort of like a script for the examiner of saying, oh, like, you can't solve it. Can you try a little harder? Something like that. And that's just sort of induced frustration as to sort of like, let's set up this totally impossible to solve situation for the child and kind of see what happens. I thought it sort of resonated a lot with in a way, the writing of the book itself, where you're sort of trying to put together the pieces of the puzzle, and maybe you can't find all the pieces, and you're not even sure how they go together. So,
oh, that's fascinating, though. So how perfect was the timing for this IRP, investigative reporting program, to kind of come about? And it was so interesting, the timing and the placement, and finally being able to get this opportunity to maybe see what's behind the, you know, the red tape, essentially.
Yeah, so in 2018, I got an academic fellowship at UC Berkeley, which allowed me to move back there, have like a little office space right across from campus, and gave me a lot of access to archives and people at the university that I wouldn't have if I wasn't there, and if I also hadn't been essentially employed by the university. Like, I was able to go into spaces that I would not have otherwise. Another way in which the timing was perfect is that the investigative reporting program sits in this little building right across the street from campus on the north side. And right down the street, like literally that street, was Tolman Hall, where I had been assessed from after preschool until I was in my early 20s. And it just so happened that when I showed up there, they were just about to begin demolishing Tolman Hall. And so Tolman was empty, and I was able to go in and go into these rooms and be in the experiment rooms where I had been studied, but then also go out and go into the observation room next door and look through the one-way mirror and be in the same places where the researchers had studied me. And that was like amazing and invaluable and weird. And they also just, over that whole period, it just happened to be, they were, that's how long it took them to tear down Tolman Hall. So to sort of see this place that had been so big in my mind, somebody else called it a memory palace, torn down by these giant like excavators and cranes, whatever the machines are, was, you know, I'm sort of building the story, but at the same time sort of watching this place that represented get torn down was fascinating. Another like weird thing that came out of it was that at a certain point I came to find that there was actually had been an animal testing laboratory in the basement of Tolman Hall, and read an essay by a guy who had been, I think he was doing doctoral research on some type of monkeys in the basement, and talked about the totally weird toxic relationship that you developed when you were studying monkeys and how hostile and weird it was. And to sort of think that during that time, people were studying animals in the basement while, you know, three, four floors up were being studied in these experiment rooms was really creepy and weird. And I eventually, I think the last thing I did in Tolman Hall was go into the basement, which was like totally weird, like bad vibes place, like never want to go there again. That was, and it had these sort of little remnants from like animal testing, like these sort of laboratory counters, and it was just, it was a very weird place.
I like that part of the book as well, where you kind of question, like, I wonder how the animals felt, I guess, just below me being tested. And it is kind of an uneasy feeling. With humans, you're kind of like, oh, that's weird. But with animals, there's people. I think you said there were protests. There were people that were trying to come in and take the animals.
Yeah.
But there were people, too. You know, like, what's the thought process here? Not long after that, though, right, is when Jack Block eventually did pass away. And I think you said you saw him in a wheelchair, right? Was that you at the end of the hallway there?
No, he actually had died in 2010 at that point. I did speak to a woman who had seen him late in life, where he had been brought back to Tolman Hall to go through, as I understand it, some of our data. And he was elderly and in a wheelchair. And it was a very sort of different memory than I'd had of him, which was, you know, this sort of vibrant, you know, enthusiastic person.
So you still, to this day, you call him Brilliant in the book. You still think very highly of Jack even to this day, or?
Sure. I mean, I think he was a complicated person. He had contentious relationships with a lot of people in academia. I think that the pursuit of what my researchers, are trying to do was honorable. They were trying to enlighten humanity. They were trying to understand how people become who they are. And those are sort of, you know, greater good pursuits. But the sort of fallout from those higher minded ideals is complicated. I see today these sort of titans of tech like Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, who are collecting these massive hordes of, they're collecting all this data on us. Their purpose is to maximize their net worth. And they are trying not to, you know, predict human behavior, but to shape it through algorithms or the images and text with which they present us. So I find those people to be sort of the modern day principal investigators conducting this global psychological experiment, which is what happens when you can survey the lives of everyone on the planet, shape their behavior, and use it to generate money for the 1%. What are the consequences of that? I can't imagine that they're good. So I think my principal investigators, by contrast, were pretty sort of innocent, naive, and well-intentioned.
And now I'm confused by, it was page, I think a near 200, 190 something, mm-hmm. where waste management is called.
Yeah.
What exactly was the... Was it because Jack was just no longer there and they didn't know what to do with everything? Or why, what was the point in destroying everything? Was it just floor plans that maybe we didn't need anymore? Or was everything included in that to be incinerated?
So based on what I was told, my understanding is that a lot of our raw data was kept in these large filing cabinets in a room called the Pink Room in Tolman Hall, on the UC Berkeley campus, and that after both our principal investigators were dead and space was limited on campus, it was decided that the Pink Room would be cleared so another researcher could come in and conduct a sleep study. So somebody had to do something with all this data. Another professor came in and pulled a bunch of the data from those filing cabinets, and that's what went to Harvard. But a lot of, as I understand it, raw data was left, and it was decided that this data should be destroyed. And so these garbage cans that the university uses that have a kind of locked lid with a slit in it were brought in and somebody was assigned the task of taking this raw data and stuffing it into these garbage cans that were then hauled away and destroyed by waste management at UC Berkeley, which deals with that sort of thing. So there was a sense of, you know, I had grown up feeling like, oh, this study is important and I'm sort of contributing to science in some way. And then to sort of find out your data ends up in like a set of garbage cans was a little disappointing.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you got everything you needed out of the research that you did. But to this point, though, that's the most research that you can do, right?
As far as I know. As far as I know, that is the end of the road. It's possible that there's more material somewhere that I'm not aware of, but I don't know that there is.
That's so heartbreaking, in a way, to not be able to access that.
Well,
just cache of information.
I don't disagree with that, but at the same time, the premise is faulty, which is like, I'm going to go undertake this journey to find myself, to find the story of my life in some place outside of myself. So who I am is in some folder, or it's in some data set, or some researcher who left some material behind can tell me who I am or who I'm supposed to be. That's not... It's only reflective of, in my life, a broader pattern of shaping my identity around the needs of other people, whether that was my narcissistic mother or, you know, various toxic relationships that I've been in. And so, like, what if there was this file? What was that going to tell me? And was I just going to believe it? Was I going to believe a researcher's version of who I am? Would that have complicated matters? If you go looking for the answer, I think just feel very strongly about this as a woman. It's like just one more woman going to some other person or some other entity. And if I can just get this person to tell me who I am or look this certain way or act this certain way, then everything will be right. And instead it's to come up kind of empty handed on that quest is like, well, thank God, because it left it to me to sort of decide who I was or decide how I wanted to tell the story rather than somebody else.
You mentioned briefly at the end of the book that you did reconnect with somebody from the program. Have you connected with anybody else during this time, especially after the book's release? Have you heard from anybody? Or?
Yeah, I connected with several people who were in the same cohort as me. I also occasionally, since the book came out, which has been really interesting, is I hear from other people who were studied. In fact, there's an interview coming out next week through Air Light magazine, which is published by University of Southern California, where this guy interviewed me and his parents were researchers and had studied him. And I've also gotten emails from people like in the UK who were research subjects in longitudinal studies and how that shaped their life. So that's really, it's like there's this tiny little population of people who were like studied. And so that's also really interesting to hear and to hear how their experiences are kind of resonate with mine. Because in a way, when I tell this story, I feel like some of the stuff I say, I think this just sounds like I'm insane. Like, it is true that the study felt like a third parent to me. But when every time I say that, I think this just sounds like this person is just psycho. You know, this is like totally weird. So when I get an email or have a conversation with somebody else who was studied and they're like, yeah, I totally get it. Or this was like, I'm like, okay, it's not just me. The other small group of people I've found that really connect with it in an intimate way is people who were child actors who are now adults. Mm-hmm. The actress Emma Roberts picked my book for her Bellatrist Book Club in December, and we did a Instagram live interview, and she just related to that some of the similar experiences of being scrutinized, having sort of other people judging you, not having a private life. And so I like those, I like having those connections. Somebody sent me, a woman sent me a message on Instagram recently where she said something like, I think maybe she's in this book club. She said, it's like it's spoke to her inner child or something. I like hearing about that. I think that's very sweet.
Oh, I love that. Because you do get a good mix of messages, I will say, based on some of the stuff that you share on your stories. So I'm glad the Morbidly Curious Book Club has sent you positive ones. I would not think otherwise, but so I'm guessing nothing ever came of a second date with that one person that you connected with. I was so disappointed. I was like, oh, this is
sorry.
I was like, oh, this is a quite the interesting love story here.
Like, this would be such a great plot twist, but no.
Well, so you would definitely always have something to talk about, I guess. Now at this point in your life, the waste management came through. We are now here with just the memories and this book. At this point, like, what is your thoughts on healing from this, not healing from this, the blocks, your parents, your sister, the relationships within? How do we feel now?
I don't know. This is sort of the million-dollar question. I mean, that process is still ongoing. I don't know if this is helpful, but so one thing, you know, my mother towards the end of the book dies, and then some weeks later I get a FedEx package that's her will, where she's essentially written me out of her will. She did give me some money, but she's given everything else to my sister. I was estranged from my mother. So, okay, fine. That's your right. But there was, reading that in document form written by an attorney is sort of a complicated experience. And part of what happens in when you do something like that is there's a lot of ways in which you're written out of the will repeatedly because it's legal and they're just like reaffirming it. And one of the sections, it says, you know, if this person dies and that person dies and that person dies, Susanna will be considered to have predeceased me, okay? Which is sort of like an over my dead body type of way of thinking about it. And the money will go to the Berkeley Public Library. So I always loved reading books, and the Berkeley Public Library was a place where I loved to go and read and pick books. And so it kind of cast this like funky splooge on like the Berkeley Public Library. So I was able to go back to the Berkeley Public Library North Branch, which was my childhood library, a few weeks ago, and I did a reading there, and it was raining and it was night, and I was reading from my book in like a basement room with the people who had showed up. And I read most of the first chapter, and there was just something personally empowering about that, that like I'm reclaiming my story, I'm reclaiming my time, I'm reclaiming my place here in this world, that I think my mother spent a lot of time psychically trying to wish me out of. And it was, you know, a lot of, you know, I've been a writer my whole life, but I didn't publish a major book until after she died. And I just spent a lot of time like giving her the space to be whatever she wanted to be. And so it's hard for me to stand up and tell my story and allow people to bear witness to that is very difficult for me. And so having the opportunity to do it for the people who like it and connect with it is meaningful to me. And, feels like kind of a gift. So it's not so much the book, but it's the sort of realigning of the story so that I'm somebody who gets to tell their story, not somebody who has to sit mute so I don't make somebody else feel uncomfortable.
Thank you so much for tuning in to our April book selection, Data Baby with Susanna Breslin. I hope you guys enjoyed the book and the episode. If you would like to become a member of the Morbidly Curious Book Club, you can certainly do so in the description of whatever podcast platform you are listening on, or just go to themorbidlycuriousbookclub.com. Also on our website, you'll be able to find our jewelry collab that I did with Midnight Narrative, who is a local talented artist here. There's of course merch and t-shirts and stuff on our bonfire page, and a Patreon if you would like to throw a couple bucks our way. No pressure, there's nothing exclusive on it, just a way to support the book club if you so please. And as always, stay safe out there, stay curious, and give your inner child a hug.
Engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.